We're doing Parshat Ki Tavoh, as we discussed earlier tonight, in the days of Ezra, the beginning of the Second Temple period. It was instituted that we read the Torah, we conclude the Torah every year, and it was instituted that we will always read Ki Tavoh 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, Tichle Shana V'Killoteha. The idea being, let's finish off the year and whatever curses had to be in this year, let's finish with them. And Tachil Shana, let a new year begin, Ubilchotel, with its blessings. So we read these curses in Ki Tavoh now. Now this teaches us a phenomenal concept. This tells us that what we read in the weekly portion is a part of life. We're not just reading history. If we read the curses this week, then there's an element where we're saying the curses are finished with this week. In 2 weeks when Rosh Hashanah comes, it's a new year. So when we read the Torah, we're living the weekly Sedra. When guys tell me they're going into the army, I often tell them, make sure to take 1 to 2 minutes a day. That's it. But 1 to 2 minutes a day to read the weekly Parsha. Even if you don't finish it, you have to stay tuned. Part of a Jew's life has to be that he knows what we're reading in the Torah this Shabbos. You buy yourself for 15 shekel, a pocket sitter. For 25 shekel, you get a full set today. For 25 shekel, you could get a full set of Chamisha Chumshei Torah with Rashi. You take 1 to 2 minutes a day. You read a little bit of the Parsha each day. You stay tuned because it should be a part of your life. Not just that you show up on Shabbos and you, interesting, what's going on. So, 25 shekels. I think even upstairs, where he sells small sets. Go look upstairs. Mordechai, upstairs in the old Beit Midrash, just above us. They sell books. I think you can buy it there for 25 shekel. I don't know. So our parsha is Parshat Ki Tavoh, and in this week's parsha, just before the Jews enter the land of Israel, Moshe tells them, you're entering on the condition that you agree that if you do not keep the Torah, there are a tremendous list of curses that are awaiting. And that's why we read it now, to finish with those curses, so to speak, before the new year begins. But our parsha does not begin with that. Our parsha begins with the mitzvah of Bikurim. When we enter the land of Israel, we know that in Israel the fruits are different than Chutzlarts. We say it in the blessing. We know there's benching, there's Birkat HaMazon, where we bless after we've eaten bread. We make a blessing that's biblical. We say 3 biblical blessings and then a 4th blessing, which is rabbinic, over the bread, the meal that we've eaten. But if we eat from the 7 species other than bread, if we eat cake or cookies, if we eat pomegranates or grapes or grape juice or wine or dates or figs, so if we eat from the 7 species, we make an after blessing that's called Mayein Shalosh. That's a conjunction. It's a shortened version of the 3 blessings of Birkat HaMazon. Now within that blessing we say, Ve'ha'aleinu letocha, bring us into the land of Israel. Ve'nochal mipiriyah, may we eat from the fruits of the land of Israel. That's what we want to do. We want to come to Israel to eat pomegranates. So the reasoning is that the fruits of the land are different than any other country. We have mitzvos with the fruits of the land. Almost every mitzvah that pertains to the fruit is only relevant in Israel. It's a rarity that we have Orla and Revai and Chutzlaretz. There are very few mitzvos that pertain to the fruits and vegetables that pertain in Chutzlaretz. You go to Chutzlaretz, you want to buy an apple, the store doesn't need a Hechsher. You want to buy an orange, if it has Jaffa oranges, then you got a problem. But if it's got American or Chinese oranges, no problem. You come to Israel, the fruits and vegetables need a Hechsher because there's a mitzvah. The fruits and vegetables are holy. You have to tithe them, you have to take off trumos, you have to take off maestros. Now we're coming up to the year of Shemitah. You want to buy fruits and vegetables, you better know if that was grown legally or illegally. We have mitzvos. The food is the basic food has mitzvos, it's holy. So we also have a mitzvah of Bikurim. You come into the land of Israel, there's a mitzvah that the first fruit of the 7 species, this is a mitzvah that's only relevant to the 7 species, the fruit of the 7 species, so we're talking about pomegranates, grapes, figs, dates, yes? We're talking about the fruits of the 7 species. So you come into your field and you see that the fruits are ripening. Now, one fruit that's a lot of fun, for the first time in my life we have one growing in our yard, is a fig tree. What's unique about a fig tree, many things are unique about a fig tree, but one thing that's unique about a fig tree is that the fruits don't ripen at the same time. So every time you walk by the tree, you could pick another fruit. Now you just have to learn how to check figs for worms. It's not so simple because the worms are little white things that look just like the inside of a fig. And you have to know how to take off the bottom of the fig because they lay eggs in the bottom. And you have to know how to look at the peel on the outside so you don't end up eating the bugs on the outside. But once you've learned how to check a fig for worms, so a fig is a very fun fruit because every time you walk by, you'll find more fruit that have ripened. It doesn't ripen all at once. That's unique to the fig tree. There's another thing unique to the fig tree, and that is that the fig tree is the one tree where you eat the peel and the fruit and the seeds. Everything's edible in the fig. It's unique to the fig. That's why tzaddikim are compared to figs, because a tzaddik is supposed to be one that everything he does benefits the world. Even things that seem mundane should be a source of blessing, of benefit to the world. Just like the fig, where nothing goes to waste. So what?
Seedless grapes.
Okay. So coming back to our... But the fig has seeds, and the seeds are delicious. So coming back to Kitavo. So we have a mitzvah. When you see the first fruit ripening, so you put a little red ribbon around it, and you collect the first fruits when they're fully ripened. You collect the first fruits, you put them in a basket, and you take them up to the temple. Now, they would do this with a lot of fanfare. They'd get together, and they'd make a huge group, and they'd go up, and they'd stop by cities on the way, and they'd sleep in the center of town, and everyone would come out to greet them, and they say, "Our brethren from this and this town, welcome. God should be with you. You should be successful." Everyone would stop their work. When you'd have a mission coming en route to the temple to bring the first fruit, everyone would stop and stand in their honor. Look at these people doing a mitzvah. They would take an ox to carry things up, and they'd coat its horns with silver so it would look all fancy, and they put a nice wreath around its neck. So it was a regal procession where a whole community would lead up their first fruits to the temple. And when they'd come to the temple, they'd bring the basket to the Kohen. So it used to be that people became like a show, a who's who, right? If you can afford a wicker basket, you brought a wicker basket. If you could afford a copper basket, you brought copper. If you could afford gold, you brought a gold basket, right? So it was a show. It's like, do you drive a Mercedes or whatnot? Everyone wanted to show off, so the poor people started being embarrassed to go up with their wicker basket. So the rabbis instituted, everyone goes up with a wicker basket, not to embarrass anyone. Same thing happened when it came to relatives dying. Relatives would die, and you had to show how much you invested in their final clothing that they'd be buried in, what's called tachrichim, until along came Rabban Gamliel and said, "I want you to bury me in jeans." Like the simplest clothing, the equivalent of jeans. In his day, it was canvas. He said, bury me, or in their day, it was linen. Bury me in the cheapest clothing. And when he did that, he brought down everyone. He said, from that point onward, everyone buries in linen, which was cheap in those days. Like a basic garment, because that was like the cheapest garment back then, the equivalent of what we might say jeans or canvases today. So it's not to embarrass those who could not. The same thing when you get married. You're going to be standing there under the chuppah. The rabbi's going to hold the cup and make a blessing of borei pri hagafen. Who's going to drink from that cup? You will. You and your kali. He's making the blessing for you. Then he makes a blessing over the engagement of your wife. He's not engaging your wife. You are. Why is he making the blessing? Because it used to be that some chatanim knew it by heart and some didn't. So they made an institution that we don't differentiate. We don't embarrass anyone. The rabbi makes the blessing for all the chatanim. But it's your blessing. It's over your mitzvah. You're engaging your wife. But we do it, the rabbi does it on behalf of the chatan, so as not to embarrass those who don't know. When they'd come up to the temple, so they'd have to read the declaration, "I hereby declare, I thank God for bringing me to this land and giving me all this wonderful fruit." So some people knew it by heart, so they'd stand there and say it out loud by heart. Then you had people who didn't know it by heart, they would be embarrassed. So they instituted that no one says it by heart. They had a chart, the Kohen would read it to the guy. So everyone, no one had to be embarrassed. Everyone had the same procession. So we see this throughout. There are many more examples of this where the rabbis ensured that there'd be an even slate so those who were less learned or those who were less wealthy wouldn't be embarrassed. So that's something to think about. It's an ethic that our sages instituted in many places. So we bring the first fruit, we bring it in a basket, we wave it before the altar, and we leave it with the basket for the Kohen. We make a declaration of appreciation. We say we know our history. We know that Lavan, the Aramean, tried to kill us. The Egyptians tried to kill us. And in all our troubles, God saved us and brought us out and gave us this wonderful gift, the temple. And on top of that, he gave us the land of Israel. And here we're connecting the land of Israel with the temple again. We're bringing our first fruits up to the Kohen. And this is another concept that repeats itself throughout the Torah, that whenever we have things, we take the first and we give it to the temple. I do this at weddings. When the kala comes and sits next to the chasen, I bring two cups and I pour water for the chasen. So I always whisper in his ear as I hand him the cup, give it to your kala. They're both thirsty, but the first cup you should give her. I'll pour you the next one. Right? And he always smiles and gives it to her. Didn't think of that, right? No one thinks of that, right? You're not used to it yet. So you guys will think of that. You know that. But you're supposed to... you see, the Torah keeps saying this. You make bread, the first portion you give to the Kohen. You have your first fruit, you bring him up to the Kohen. You have your firstborn son, so you have a mitzvah to redeem him. It's as though he's the first one is for Hashem. Your first animal goes to the temple. This idea that whenever I do something, I inaugurate it with the recognition it's for God. And when I was a kid, I liked this idea. So I decided that whenever I get something new, I'll try to do the first thing, a mitzvah with it. I remember when I bought the first car, $300. I bought cars for $300. And back then, $300 wasn't so different than now. It's not like, you know, back when $300 was worth something. It was a jalopy, but it worked, right? So I tried to make sure my first ride would be to do a shop for my mother. And later on, I found it written. There are some works that say that this is something you should aspire to. Meaning the concept we see in the Torah. That when we have something, we should always try to inaugurate it with the mitzvah. So then we have a mitzvah of declaring on our taxes. At the end of 3 years, we make a declaration that we fulfilled our dues. We've given our tithe, we've given our truma, our maaser, our bikurim, what's called vidui maaser. I make a declaration, I've paid my dues in the tithing and the different gifts I'm supposed to give. Now we're going to have it, now in the Shemitah year. We end another three-year cycle. We're supposed to make a declaration, Erev Pesach, that we finished our dues. And that brings us to Shlishi. When we make the declaration, I'm going back for a point. When we bring our first fruit and we make a declaration that we thank God for giving us this land and promising the land He promised us and our forefathers. So here... there's actually a discussion, can a ger, can a convert say this declaration? And the same discussion applies, can a convert say, Shasa Nisim Lavosenu? Can a convert say in Shmona Esrei, Elokeinu V'Elokei Avosenu? So there's a famous letter by the Rambam to Rabbi Ovadia the ger. We learned it. If we'd have time, I was going to do it this week on Thursday night. It's not such a long letter. And the Rambam over there writes, the concept of Avram being Av Hamon Goyim, the father of nations, is to teach us that, let's say, I am a great, 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 you got to do that about 30 times, to Avram Avinu, grandson to Avram Avinu. But a ger is his son. He's closer to Avram Avinu. I'm more distant. And that's why a ger can say, Elokeinu V'Elokei Avosenu, and the blessing of Shasa Nisim Lavosenu, because he is a part of it all. That's the idea of Avram being told, you are the father of nations. That from now on, the Rambam is actually telling us a very nice concept, that the ger is closer to Avram. The ger gets called up to the Torah, he's called Ben Avram. It's like Avram's his father. I have to go back 30 generations to get to Avram Avinu. He calls Avram my father. That's the idea that Rambam writes in his letter. And again, that concept begins in the Mishnah in the discussion of how can a convert say, I thank you Hashem for giving me the land you promised my fathers. How does that work? So that's how it works. Okay. We discussed the 12 stones as we were learning Joshua. We discussed the division of the nation on Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And our parsha is where we're told to go aboard those two mountains. And then we have 11 curses. Moshe tells us when we enter the land of Israel, we will have to make this declaration. 11 things that we say. Cursed is he who makes an idol and hides it from everyone else. Cursed is he who... The idea of these 11 curses are 11 things which you would do, which a person might do in hiding. 11 things that we're basically accepting responsibility we won't do because a person can do it and hide it from everyone else. So as we're entering the land of Israel, there are 11 things we accepted upon ourselves. So the pasuk says, "Aru makle avi ve'imo." Cursed is he who derides, who does something that's deprecating to his parents, his father or his mother. And this teaches us an obligation above and beyond kibud avaim. We know there's an obligation to service our parents. That's what we call kibud avaim. It is a mistranslation to say honor your parents. Kibud avaim really means service your parents. If they need help putting on a jacket, if they need help getting into a car, they need help doing a shop, you could use their credit card, but you have to help them with the time, with the service. So there's kibud avaim, there's mora avaim. Well, mora is more like respecting them, not to contradict them, not to say things that are disrespectful. And then you have this commandment, where the Jews are taking a responsibility not to do something that would slight their honor. So that would include where father says, "The Yankees won the World Series in 96. And you go, "Huh." All you did was say, "Huh." But you made it show, like, what does he know? And that's prohibited. So our obligations are in the realm of respect and service. That doesn't mean they control our lives. If a parent says, "I want you to grow your forelocks 7 inches, not 6 inches," that's none of his business. It doesn't matter. If a parent says, "I want you to marry an Ashkenazi girl, I want you to marry a Sephardi girl, I want you to marry a girl from the north or the south," that doesn't matter. It's not his right, it's not his prerogative, it's none of his business. Honoring parents is in these three realms. Servicing, respecting, doesn't mean obeying, means respecting, and not doing something that would slight their honor. But that doesn't mean we're their servant, that they can order us to lead our lives the way they see fit. That's not part of honoring one's parents. The Parsha promises us that as we keep the Torah, we will see limitless blessing, limitless success in the land of Israel. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we will fulfill that part of the Parsha. Shabbat.